The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Brewers podcast, joining you on what would have been the first week of the 2020 baseball season. Of course, by now, unfortunately, you know that's not what's going to happen. The baseball season has been delayed at least until May, quite likely longer than that, as well as the rest of the world, because of the coronavirus spreading throughout Europe, throughout Asia, throughout the United States. It is all over the world, and everything is on hold, including baseball. We will still try to offer you a little bit of Milwaukee Brewers content. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Milwaukee Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast. I am joined on the other lines. They are socially isolated like the rest of us. Tom Hodricourt and Todd Rosiak, both Milwaukee Brewers beat reporters for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gentlemen, it has been a month. It has been a year in the course of the last month or the last 2 weeks. How are things shaping up? What has been life like for you guys?
Well, if this gives you any idea, I just got done walking my cat.
That's incredible. Do you put him on a leash?
Yeah, put him on a harness and a leash. He loves it. He's like a dog.
That's outstanding, and it gives you an excuse and a reason to be outside. That's fantastic news.
Yeah.
I've been walking my dog, so it sounds like we're on a similar pursuit here, playing with our pets. And I will suggest to you that they don't have the slightest idea what social distancing means.
No, I imagine they don't, and I don't have pets, but I do have two children, so for better or worse, we are able to, we will need to get outside quite a bit, at least once a day, to, it's happening. We were getting outside once a day when I was in Kentucky last week with my parents, and that was no problem. Lots of room to roam, lots of open spaces. It's a little bit more cramped now that we're back in Greater Milwaukee, but we're gonna work through it. Like everybody else, we are working through it.
And, one of my neighbors, JR, who has two children who were home from school last Monday, the first day of the school shutdown, just after one day, he told me that after one day of homeschooling, he's ready to triple the salaries of teachers if we'll just put the kids back in school.
My wife, the school teacher, that's music to her ears, although although right now, I don't know. It's, it's a scramble for just about everybody involved. Yes, the idea of actually raising my own children in my house is paralyzing, but we'll see what we can do here. We'll get a little bit to our 50th anniversary section that came out in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this week. That, of course, was in anticipation of the 50th season, the 50th anniversary of Milwaukee Brewers baseball, or baseball in Milwaukee, the second time around. And we'll talk about that a little bit as well. For starters, we obviously don't know exactly what's going to happen with the Major League Baseball season. Craig Counsell, I know, has said, you guys have written about Craig Counsell saying he still believes baseball is going to happen. And right now, I think that's just hope and faith for all of us. I personally have my doubts that we're going to see baseball at all in 2020. But if we do see it, it's not going to come until most likely June or July at the most optimistic. I guess I'll start with Tom. What do you see as the options for baseball? Do you see as a straight up after it becomes clear that they can get no less than a half or no more than a half season in? Do they ultimately say we're just going to be done with 2020? I mean, how much of the season would they be willing to sort of scale back? And what are their options for sort of making this work logistically before they finally say, you know what, let's just scrap 2020?
Right. Well, what they would have to do, and I have the same skepticism you have of whether they're going to be able to play this year or not, especially when you see some of the things about the coronavirus not even being close to being under control yet. The key to the whole thing, JR, is how late would they be willing to play into the year, and then what type of format would they use at the end of the year? Would they still try to get all the rounds of playoffs in? You'd almost have to put it in predetermined domed ballparks if you play on into November. So that's what they, and I'm guessing they're already talking about that stuff. You know, what are we willing to call a season? You know, I go back to 1981 when they had the strike split season that year, and they basically played two half seasons, and then the two half season champions played each other in the first round of the playoffs. If we get to that point where it is just half a season, they're going to have to alter the playoffs in some way. Maybe they're not going to be able to let as many teams in. Maybe they're going to have to change it all to best two out of three, except for the World Series. And maybe that'll be have to be three out of five. I mean, they're just going to have to figure out something that's acceptable and acceptable against not playing at all. You know, I think almost anything's more acceptable than not playing at all. And, I think Craig Counsell kind of was a little was looking into a crystal ball the other day when he said, I think we're going to have baseball, but it's going to look different and we're going to have to be okay with that. And that's what it's that if they play it, it's going to look different and we're going to have to be okay with it.
Todd, I know you were there at spring training right before everything hit the fan and guys were sent home, or at least initially were given the option to stay in Arizona. Can you kind of describe those last days? The Brewers lost their last couple games because of rain and then knew that things were kind of getting to get suspended after that. What was it like there? What were the players saying? What were the coaches saying? I mean, at that point, it had to be kind of scary for guys to not know what's coming up next.
Yeah, it was kind of surreal, actually, because if we go back to that previous Monday when we were first notified that the clubhouses were going to be closed beginning Tuesday, it was like, well, wait, aren't we overreacting a little bit here? Well, as we all know, certainly not at this point, but that's how fast things change. So we had access to the clubhouse that final evening. That was the night of the Maryvale night game. And the Brewers were, you know, Mike Vassallo and his staff were very good about trying to put together a scenario that worked for all parties, players, media. So beginning the next day, we had our quote unquote clubhouse sessions in a small, basically equipment storage room with a couple of tables set up and some chairs and everything. Now looking back on it, obviously the social distancing was not practiced, but we didn't know it was as crucial back then. That's how fast these things changed. But it went from really kind of joking about it and, well, boy, this is weird, and oh, you better stand 3 feet away, to Friday booking our flights back home. You know, that's how quickly all this stuff changed. And, you know, we weren't shaking hands with players by Wednesday. And then Thursday was that final day where all of a sudden, you know, the mandate was handed down that spring training was over and the season was going to be pushed back. So in the span of 3 days, it was incredible. And to me, the kind of the ground zero day, if you want to call it that or whatever, was that Wednesday and how fast things changed. We were in the press box in Glendale, Camelback Ranch, when the Brewers were playing the Dodgers. And right before the game started, you know, everybody's scanning Twitter and all of a sudden, oh, Tom Hanks has coronavirus and his wife. And then not long after that, the players were leaving the court in Oklahoma City. And then not long after that, Rudy Gobert tested positive for corona. And that's when everything just totally, totally changed. So, you know, we went down to the clubhouse after the game and we talked to Freddie Peralta, talked to Craig Counsell, and nobody really knew how to make heads or tails of what was happening, and things were changing so rapidly. So, you know, from that to all of a sudden now, who knows what's next? And, you know, you guys are talking about what the season could entail, what it could hold. You know, to me, if baseball's played, this is just going to kind of be known as the giant asterisk season. If it's half a season, a quarter season, whatever, you know, whatever happens, if you can get some games in, it's just, it's going to be that basically that asterisk season, and then hopefully everything kind of goes back to normal in 2021. It's pretty surreal talking about this, but it's the reality of things now, unfortunately.
Yeah, Tom, talking about that strike split 1981 season is sort of an asterisk in a similar regard, and maybe during the World War II in the 1940s, when a lot of the best players in the game were, you know, fighting for their country and weren't always, you know, even in their prime, available to play baseball. I think we look at those years and sort of talk about that stuff, but they still played baseball, and we aren't guaranteed that in 2020. And that is something that is just flat out unprecedented in the game of baseball. Tom, if they are able to ramp back up, this has been a hot topic of conversation, how that would look for baseball. I mean, obviously, a lot of these guys are essentially going to be reset. The spring training that they got in isn't really going to matter because they'll have lost all that momentum. I certainly don't expect that if they get a chance to play again, that they're going to take a full month and a half worth of spring training to get up to speed. But there'll need to be some time to get pitchers stretched out, to get guys back in the groove, whatever that looks like. Do you speculate, first of all, how long do you think that would be? And what sort of roster adjustments do you speculate could be on the table or ways that they can work around this? Because we might see starting pitchers that just can't go more than like 3 or 4 innings through the first couple weeks of the season. How do you think that part of it plays out?
Well, I'll go to another strike-altered season, 1995, to answer that question. They had replacement ball going on in spring training for a month, and when it was finally shut down, basically by Judge Sotomayor's ruling, she's now on the Supreme Court, ruling to end the strike. So players, the real players, showed up, and they did a 3-week spring training. And I think everybody agrees that if their baseball just consisted of hitters, 3 weeks would be plenty. Those guys, that's all they need to get ready in there, and let's go. But the pitchers need twice that long, and which is why we have a 6-week spring training. But that year, when they held a 3-week spring training, they got the pitchers as stretched out as they could. At least these pitchers, some of these have already thrown some in spring training. That year, they're coming cold off their workouts. They stretched them out the best they could for 3 weeks. And then they allowed, I want to say, 3 extra pitchers to be held on your roster. I think we went from 25 to 28 players to open the season to give 3 extra pitchers because they knew they were going to need them with pitchers not stretched out. So I'm guessing minimum 3 weeks. That precedent has been set. And again, we were going to go to 26 players this year anyway, but I think now we'll probably go to 30 for like the first month or 6 weeks until they get pitchers stretched out. This is Craig Counsell might have his September right out of the chute with all the extra pitchers, and they might just bullpen the heck out of games like they love doing anyway. But I think that's the bare minimum. And I fully expect JR that spring training, the Brewers spring training, will be held at Miller Park. I don't see teams going back to Arizona and Florida to do 3 weeks of spring training. That would be a logistical nightmare and a financial nightmare too. They're already losing so much money. And by then the weather will be nice enough across the whole country for even the northernmost teams without roofs to have spring training in their own ballparks. And then I think for exhibition games, you'd either play inter-squad games or the Brewers would play the Cubs and the White Sox a lot. Just go up and down the highway and do that. But that's how I envision spring training part two happening.
Yeah, this could be a really interesting, if there's baseball, interesting busy schedule for Miller Park because spring training, like you said, kind of makes sense that there'd be games here. Maybe if this season is extended on the other half, like if they use the entire month of October for regular season games and they decide that some games have to be played in roof domed stadiums, there could be a whole bunch of games scheduled to be played in other stadiums played in Milwaukee. I mean, I could even see double headers. It's a really fascinating uncharted territory, and we have no idea what it's going to look like. Todd, Brewer specific as it relates to the storylines that we were following in spring training, curious what maybe 2 or 3 unresolved things are that the Brewers would essentially still have to answer in whatever format of spring training that we would get on the other side of this. I know that if you've got a roster of 30 guys, it means that they can wait on someone like Logan Morrison, a guy who was right on the fence of making the roster or not. Well, he would definitely make it in an expanded roster situation. So that would enable the Brewers to sort of, hang on to him for a little bit longer. And certainly there'd be some position battles that wouldn't have to be solved right away. What were kind of the 2 or 3 top of mind storylines that might still be question marks if we get into a season here?
Yeah, well, the pitching is obviously going to be the interesting thing, and how many additional bodies they're going to be able to use. Like Tom said, they could start out doing the September bullpenning thing. To me, really the most compelling battle or the most interesting storyline was, shortly before everything changed, Craig Counsell had told us that both Corbin Burnes and Freddie Peralta were on the opening day roster in roles TBD. Now that fifth starter spot was open because Eric Lauer had suffered his shoulder injury. Corbin Burnes had pitched really, really well up to that point in spring training, and Freddie Peralta was doing very well too. So You know, how that all would have shaken out would have been very interesting to see. Now, obviously, things have changed, and you know, roles will change even more, and who knows what'll happen. Obviously, those two guys would definitely still be in the mix with an expanded roster. You know, you would figure that Eric Lauer's shoulder would be fine by that point too, so you've got more bodies to work with. So that was one, and you know, the Lomo thing was the other one that jumped to mind that you had already mentioned, and you know, certainly he had filled the role that the Brewers had kind of envisioned for him, were he to make the roster, which was power, left-handed power bat off the bench. And he was doing exactly that in the playing time that he'd gotten in Cactus League play. So, you know, hey, that's another one. And let's bring him aboard. He's definitely an interesting guy. A lot of storylines from him, and a lot of interesting things to say as far as Lomo is concerned. So, Those are the two that really kind of jumped to the forefront for me.
All right, so without surefire baseball in our immediate future, we turn our eyes a little bit to the past. Like I mentioned, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel released the 50th anniversary special edition on Sunday of the in anticipation of this Brewers 50th anniversary season that that may happen still, may not. But we did get a chance to look back at all the highlights in Brewers history. You guys did a ton of work on this. Talked to a lot of, you know, a lot of people from the past, and looked back at some great storylines, some of the best trades in team history, certainly some of the best players, stories on the team switching leagues and on the team moving and from Seattle in 1969 when the Pilots came to Milwaukee, and sort of the frantic, crazy 6 days it took to, or 6 days transition period where they were able to kind of pull this off on short notice. That was probably my favorite story in the whole section. But a couple areas that we can discuss here. First of all, the Mount Rushmore, the Big Four Brewers personalities. I found that to be kind of a compelling discussion. You guys ultimately decided on a couple easy choices, that being Robin Yount and Paul Molitor. And again, it was just players, so Bob Uecker wouldn't be in the mix here, or one of the executives like Bud Selig wouldn't be in the mix. And then the last two landed on Ryan Braun and Cecil Cooper. And it was tough to come up with those last two. So give me a sense on some of the conversations you guys had and how you ultimately came up with those four guys as the four sort of Mount Rushmore faces of Brewers baseball.
Well, I'll go first on this because, you know, if we would have said all people were eligible, it would have been the easiest story and probably boring to do, because it would have been obviously Yount, Molitor, Selig, and Uecker. It would have been such an easy Mount Rushmore. Those are easily the four probably highest profile people in club history. But we said, let's go players only. And boy, I almost wish we would have gone back and just done Yount, Molitor, Selig, and Uecker. Because the last two choices, Todd and I went back and forth. We talked to other people about it. We knew one would be controversial, Ryan Braun, because of the PED thing. And then the other, we actually had Fielder on Mount Rushmore, and we had the stone carvers come back, scrape him off, and put Cecil Cooper on there. And
needed a lot of scraping. That's a big man to get unchiseled from rock.
No kidding. But Todd and I talked a lot about it. And, you know, for sheer great seasons, Fielder was our choice. But just for longtime contributions and where he stands on so many club lists, Cecil Cooper eclipsed him. He also has probably the biggest hit in Brewers history. Is there a bigger hit in Brewers history than the one that won the pennant? They've only won one pennant.
Yep, that is it. Number one moment in Brewers history, easily.
Yeah, and I know you did the moments, and that you had an easy time with that one. So, so we went with Cooper. So I'll let Todd talk about it now. But this was harder than people thought it was, because of we knew people would say you can't put Braun on there; he's tarnished. I had a lot of people that also wanted Jim Gantner on there, and it would have been real easy to do Molitor, Yount, and Gantner as far as probably most beloved players in club history, but. And no respect to Gumby, because we all love him, but we just thought his body of work didn't match the body of work of Braun and Cooper. What do you say?
I mean, if you go by longevity, I don't think there's any question that, you know, Gumby would have been the guy and would have made sense there. But in terms of sheer impact, the Cooper and Prince argument was definitely a compelling one. And you said it earlier, you know, if you go by sheer monster seasons and numbers, you know, a 50 home run season, you know, playing every game essentially for a span of about 5 years, like Prince Fielder did, you know, you could definitely tilt the scales in Prince's favor. But, you know, the obviously the huge hit that Cooper had, just the sustained run of excellence, you know, multiple All-Star games, tremendous defensive player, won Gold Gloves, you know, leading the league in hitting, those kinds of things, and still ranking up there on many of the club's offensive lists, just tilted the scales a little bit in Cooper's favor. And, you know, as somebody who grew up in that era and watched him and as a fan, as a kid, you know, he was my favorite player. It wasn't Robin Yount. It wasn't Paul Molitor. It was Cecil Cooper because of that cool stance. It still amazes me to this day that guy could hit with the way he stood at the plate. But he was just a tremendous player for a long period of time and a really a key cog in those great early 80s teams. So, you know, if you could have five guys on Mount Rushmore, I think Prince then becomes the no-brainer fifth. And then the argument would definitely be interesting after that. But it was a fun exercise. And I enjoyed the back and forth and the tapping different people and discussing it and looking at numbers and everything. And that was to me probably the most fun thing in the section, just as far as kind of the back and forth and the rationale and the reasoning and everything for it. So hopefully it generated discussion and I'm sure it did. And, you know, judging by the emails I got, and I'm sure Tom got as well, it seems like it served that purpose.
Yeah, Cooper, 11 seasons with the Brewers. Fielder, 7 only, and really just 6, came up halfway through that first season in 2005. Fielder hit 50 home runs in a season. And when it comes to power numbers, he was pretty fun to watch. On the 6 big full-time seasons he had in Milwaukee were just monstrous and coincided with some pretty important baseball, the 2008-2011 trips to the playoffs. But Cooper has that too. 81, 82, he's part of that turnaround. He's there in 87. I mean, he's a guy who definitely... I would have picked Cooper when you guys originally told me you were leaning toward Braun and Fielder. I definitely thought Cooper should have an edge over one of those guys. I would have picked Braun too. Todd, let me ask you this, because I wrote about this last year or 2 years ago. What happens when Ryan Braun ultimately retires if the franchise elects to retire his number? I realize this isn't the most important conversation out there, but he is... I mean, he's the franchise's all-time leader in home runs. He's going to, you know, easily be one of the best in all time. Maybe, you know, I think you could say he's one of the three best players all time next to Robin Yount and Paul Molitor, and maybe even ahead of Molitor in terms of overall production. He's hit so many clutch home runs. He has been monumental to this franchise, and yet there is the PED cloud, of course. And I don't know what the club is going to want to do. I mean, if this is his last year with the Brewers and maybe in baseball, a few years from now, they're gonna be looking around thinking, should we put number 8 up on the facade? It's kind of sort of mixed feelings. I mean, what do you think the Brewers are gonna how are they gonna evaluate that? What do you think they're gonna do?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's not an easy answer to it. You know, obviously the stain of the PED thing will be forever with him, but you know, he's over the course of his career, the body of his career, I think he's definitely left a positive overall impact on the franchise. He's been visible in the community, and I think he's really tried to make amends for his past indiscretions, especially in recent years. It wouldn't surprise me if maybe the franchise kind of hopes that left it to time heals all wounds and maybe not addresses it right away, but holds that number back. If anybody's noticed over the years, there has not been a number 17 issued for a long time, if not ever, after Gumby hung him up. And that's not by accident. You know, his number isn't retired, but it's just not issued. And I could see something like that happening with Ryan Braun, kind of, you know, it's not being announced, but it's just the number is not going to be issued. And then maybe, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the line. Who knows if it would be that long? All of a sudden it happens. But, you know, maybe Tom has a different take on it. But to me, maybe after some time has passed and, you know, you get to a point where if you think it becomes time to honor him, then you do it. But it's definitely an interesting conversation to have.
Now, what do you think, Tom? Because he's had a decade since the PED suspension, not quite a decade, but he's played it, you know, pretty, he's been there straight and narrow since then. So what do you think about this?
Well, first I'd like to get one burr out of my saddle and say we can't even get anybody on the stinking Walk of Fame, much less retire their number.
That is true. What is going on with that?
that just irks the hell out of me. It just irks me. Todd can tell you, it just irks me. Who's voting on this? What are we doing? Put some people on the stinking Walk of Fame. It's not Cooper. It's easier to get in Cooperstown. Ted Simmons got in Cooperstown. I don't think he could ever get on the Walk of Fame.
Yeah, I don't know. Raleigh Fingers and him played the same number of seasons in Milwaukee. Ted Simmons is going to be on that Walk of Fame or I riot. That has to happen.
Well, I'm telling you, I got 10 people that are just so qualified, it's not even funny. How is George Bamberger not on there? Give me a break with that. Just as profanity alone, he should have a special place on the Walk of Fame.
Yes.
So, but no, I think Todd was right on with the withholding the jersey and tabling that discussion. Let's just cut to the chase on Ryan Braun. You know, he did PEDs. We know he did PEDs for a short period of time in 2011. It was never proved that he did them any other time. And I guarantee he was tested profusely after 2011. The cover up was the brutal part. And, you know what? He may step to a microphone one day and address that. I think Todd will agree with me that we've heard stuff behind the scenes that he really rues that, but he just hasn't figured out what to do about it yet. And he has been a model citizen since, including in the community. And people can say, well, you know, he could be a model citizen now. Well, he didn't have to be. He could have just, like, you know, shielded himself off from everybody forevermore. But, you know, to his credit, he's been a model citizen since he made a bad mistake and compounded it with bad behavior. But since then, you know, I think he's been great with us in the clubhouse. He's been great with his teammates. I think he's been a mentor to people. He's really tried to put that sordidness behind him. And it'll be interesting to see how the club reacts. You know, Mark Attanasio seems to have made peace with him, and I think he'll have a say in that. You know, he owns the club. So I would, you know, since they've withheld Gumby's number this long, though, I would like to see him go ahead and retire. Let's retire. You know, let's get him up there too. We didn't get him on our Mount Rushmore, but he is one of the most beloved players ever on Wisconsin's own. And he's been in a Brewers uniform ever since he retired, helping out as an unofficial coach, too. He qualifies in every way for me. This is the Brewers honoring players, not Cooperstown. Let's divide those two things into two separate things, please.
Yeah, Jim Gantner, player from 1976 to 1992, here a long time. I wonder if there are other situations across baseball that are like his, where the guy's number isn't officially retired. I mean, I think everybody can acknowledge it's not like his numbers were otherworldly. He was just he was certainly above average for a good part of his career, especially defensively.
Yeah, everything that's right about the game, though, and I'm pretty sure, and we'll probably hear from somebody via text or email, but I'm pretty sure when he retired, he was the active leader in defense at second base, certainly in the American League and maybe in the major leagues.
Yeah. Yeah, he's an interesting situation where, like you said, they're not retiring his number because I guess you just don't do that for a beloved player, but there's maybe nobody more beloved. Maybe Robin Yount is more beloved over the course of history, but Jim Gantner way, way up there. So that leads in a little bit to the 50th anniversary team. You tried to select a roster of the greatest players in Brewers history, and most of these are pretty pretty self-explanatory. Guys that we've talked about. Your first baseman are Cecil Cooper and Prince Fielder. No problems there. Second base, Jim Gantner and Ricky Weeks, who had some pretty special years during his run with the Brewers. Shortstop, Robin Yount, is where you decided to put Robin Yount. He, of course, split his career between shortstop and center field. He's there with J.J. Hardy. You've got Molitor and Jeff Cirillo at third base. Lucroy and Simmons at catcher. Braun, Ben Ogilvy in left field. Gorman Thomas is your center fielder by himself. Right fielder is Christian Yelich and Jeff Jenkins. Starting pitchers are Pete Vukovich, who won a Cy Young, Mike Caldwell, Teddy Higuera, Yovani Gallardo, and Ben Sheets. Quite honestly, I think that's a pretty easy call on the starting five, although you may feel differently. I'll bring up one name here in a minute. Relief pitchers, Rolly Fingers, of course, who was MVP and Cy Young, Ken Sanders, K-Rod, Francisco Rodriguez. I find him to be an interesting choice. John Axford, Dan Plesac, and Josh Hader. So a couple of the honorable mention guys that you list that didn't make the cut include some starting pitchers like Jim Slayton, who was the guy I was going to bring up, as well as Moose Haas, Cal Eldred, Chris Bosio, Sabathia, and Greinke. Some interesting cases in there. Other than that, I didn't see too many guys that I thought were snubs, so to speak. Don Money at third base, maybe Greg Vaughn in left field, but for the most part, did you find that exercise was a little bit easier than the Mount Rushmore? I guess we'll start with Todd.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it took more deliberation, a lot more investigative work to do it. You had positions that were really no-brainers, and I would say a lot of those qualified. But then, you know, we ran into issues. You know, we decided, like take shortstop and center field for instance. Obviously, Robin Yount's the no-brainer shortstop, but he was also a darn good center fielder too. And would he be eligible as a center fielder as well? Ultimately, we decided not to do that. Kind of spread the wealth a little bit, if you will. So we had some of those discussions, and you know, guys who made really large impacts over a short amount of time too. Some of those discussions and arguments were interesting as well. I mean, you know, you talk about the starting pitching. You know, could CC Sabathia have qualified for that list pitching one half of a season? Maybe some people would argue that because of the impact that he had. It was amazing in 2008. So there, you know, there were arguments like that as well. And that was just kind of more fun as far as the exercise went. JR, I heard you mention Jim Slayton, for instance. That name, to me, he's one of the most criminally underrated players in franchise history. And talking about, you know, Walk of Fame and all this stuff, you know, if you go back and you look at his numbers and what he did over the course of his career with the Brewers, he's right up there in all the pitching lists as well. You know, not a household name or anything, but a guy that really made a big impact on the franchise for a long time. So yeah, I got a real kick out of doing this. It was a lot of fun. And again, you know, being a guy born and raised in the area and having watched all these guys growing up and, you know, others that I have since covered, it was really cool and really fun to do. And, probably one of the neater things I've been a part of, in a long time working at the JS. And Tom, what do you have to add with all this?
Well, I want to credit Todd for Ben Ogilvy being on the list, because I was pushing hard for who? Maybe Greg Vaughn? Is that who it was? Yeah, but Greg Vaughn?
Yeah.
And then Todd said, and Todd had the advantage of being in Milwaukee in the early 80s. I didn't get here till 85. Now, I, you know, pride myself on knowing what happened prior to that as well. But Todd said, Tom, go look at Ben Ogilvy a little closer. And I did. And man, was he right. And he had some tremendous power years for the Brewers. But he just got overshadowed by some of the other power years, like Gorman Thomas and people like that. So I was really thankful to have Todd, you know, as a native Milwaukee, and knowing that that was something closer to look at. The other thing is, I totally agree with the criminally underrated thing for Jim Slayton. And I'd say a close second as far as pitching goes is Moose Haas. Go back and look at his career. He had some really good years for the Brewers, but just not, you know, on the first team. I do think it was easy to pick those five. Pete Vukovich didn't pitch a long time, but when he did, he was the best thing they had. And so, like Todd said, we decided not to put duplicate players, or we would have had Molitor at both third base and DH, and Robin at both shortstop and center field. So, and we fudged a little bit to 26 players, But that's what baseball was doing this year anyway, so we didn't feel as like we were putting one over on the readers there. And so we and I tell you nothing, and I think Todd will agree on this. We gave Carlos Gomez really strong consideration at center field, and we almost decided to go to 27 players and make him the backup to Gorman Thomas, because that's the only position we don't have two players, right, Todd?
Right. Yep. Yeah, we did. We did deliberate on that quite a bit. And another position too that we went back and forth on, and this wasn't as strong an argument. DH, you know, obviously the Brewers before they jumped to the NL. But you go back and you look at the DHs, the guys that played the most games at DH for the Brewers over that course of time, and it really was not a super compelling group. Let's just say that. Tom, wasn't it Dave Nielsen and Don Money were the two finalists?
Yeah.
For that?
Yeah. And we have Don Money in honorable mention at third base, and he's another guy just because he was so well known with the franchise in the early years that we gave strong consideration to. And then Nielsen we have as the backup catcher. But you know what, JR, we went back and looked at it, and I think Nielsen played the outfield and DH more than he caught with the Brewers. He caught for a few years and then he stopped catching, but he was a really good hitter over that time.
Yeah, I would be surprised to – I believe you when you say that, but I think of him as a catcher. You know, the baseball card picture of him in my head, he's got his catching gear on, so that would be surprising, but I do believe it. One, I think, more underrated guy, not that I think he should have made the team or anything, but from more recent years, I think people forget how good Aramis Ramirez was when he was
right
here. He came right in the aftermath of Prince Fielder, and my favorite stat about the 2012 Brewers is that they hit more home runs in 2012 than they did in 2011 when they were in the NLCS with Fielder and Braun kind of at the peak of their powers, and Ramirez was a big reason why, and he was here for 3.5 years, which I think people forget. Late in his career, of course, but he mashed. He was everything they could have hoped he was. Maybe not one of the best third basemen in franchise history, or maybe not one of the top two, but he's after that, he's in the conversation. An interesting.
Yeah, we have him in honorable mention at the race. And you know what? He played so well during his original 3-year contract that he became one of the few players I've ever seen that had a mutual option exercised by both sides.
That is a rare thing.
That hardly ever happens.
Trivia question. Let's see if either one of you can get it. Probably will. Who did the Brewers get in the trade of Aramis Ramirez to the Pirates?
Oh, I know this too. Is it Trace Schupak? No.
No.
Oh, I know this. I know this.
He came over with Keon Broxton for Jason Rogers.
Yeah. Oh, it's somebody that did not play for them, I don't think.
He did pitch in the majors. He made
I got it. I know it.
A couple brief appearances, and that was it. And he blew out his shoulder.
I'm so proud of myself. I know it, and I have not looked it up. I promise you. Is it Jonathan Berrios?
Yeah, very good.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes me feel very good. Yes.
That guy had such promise, and then just blew his shoulder apart. You know what?
Yep.
I think that story could be played for just about, I mean, what, half of the pitching prospects, and maybe across baseball, but definitely in Milwaukee Brewers history, even on this list.
The karma came with that thing that Todd just mentioned, the Jason Rogers trade. That's where the karma came back when the Brewers got Schupak and Keon Broxton for Jason Rogers.
Yeah, I asked both those guys about that this spring, and they were laughing how they're basically seated across from the clubhouse from each other, still with the Brewers, although Keon did leave briefly. And then you've got Bobby Wall as well, the guy that the Brewers got, and one of the guys the Brewers got in exchange for Keon Broxton. So talk about the trade that keeps on giving.
Yeah, that is true. That worked out for the Brewers. Even if you just have what Keon Broxton has done in his career, it would outperform what Jason Rogers did for the Pirates. So that worked out quite nicely. Any other aspects of the 50th anniversary that you guys particularly enjoyed?
I'll go first. Since I was tasked with going back and kind of rating the draft's hits and first round hits and busts, I found that a very interesting exercise. In so much as there were some names that, like, you know, obviously I was born in 71, so some of those early guys that went in the first round, I had no idea who they were. And you know, trying kind of following their careers, and how few of those guys actually panned out. It was really amazing. But you look at it, the draft is such a crapshoot anyway. Pretty much every organization has failed and failed miserably on many, many first round picks. That's just the nature of the beast. But as you got into the 80s and then into the 90s, some of those names really kind of made me chuckle. And then looking and seeing how far they did or didn't make it before leaving the organization, that was a lot of fun. And then seeing some of the hits as well. It could have been a really deep diving exercise had we, you know, gone into later rounds and pulled out some of the real gems, you know, from later in the draft and so forth. But, you know, and obviously there's limited amount of time and space, so we limited it to the first round. But that to me was a good deal of fun.
Yeah, the Brewers went through a notoriously bad stretch of first round picks in the 90s, and I think it's probably more notable that though that went through a stretch where they were hitting way more than they were missing in the early 2000s. You had, well, this is after like Dave Krinzel and Mike Jones. I believed Mike Jones was going to be the next great thing in Milwaukee. That was a huge disappointment personally for me, drafted in 2001. But then Fielder, Ricky Weeks, Mark Rogers, who had arm trouble, Ryan Braun in 05, Jeremy Jefferson in 06, Matt LaPorta, who's part of the Sabathia trade, Brett Lowry, who was traded for Sean Markham, Jake Odorizzi, who's still in the big leagues. I mean, that is a run right there.
They had a really nice run, a lot of it under Jack Sorensic.
And then right. Dylan Covey in 2010, he didn't sign with the Brewers, but he did eventually make it to the majors with the White Sox.
Right. Yeah.
So, JR, so let me leave us with a laugh on the podcast today with my favorite draft story. It involved the only draft pick, number one draft pick ever by the Seattle Pilots, Gorman Thomas.
Yes.
Gorman Thomas was in high school in South Carolina, and he was out playing baseball, and he said his mom called him into the house and said, this is before cell phones and, you know, electronic drafts. This is all you found out stuff, you know, almost via, not via Pony Express, but close to it. Gorman said his mom called him into the house and said, "You've just been drafted by the Seattle Pilots." Well, this was 1969, and the Vietnam War was going hot and heavy, and he thought he had been drafted into military service.
Oh, my God.
He thought the Seattle Pilots were part of the Coast Guard.
Oh, my God. So he's thinking his life is in danger, right?
Yeah, I mean, he broke into tears, sobbing uncontrollably, and his mom says, "Why are you so upset?" And he said, "Well, I don't want to go into the service. I want to play baseball." And I think that's what she said. "Hey, the Seattle Pilots are a baseball team, Gorman."
Incredible. He is definitely one of the more colorful characters. Glad to see he made the 50th anniversary team. Definitely. I think the thing people forget about him is big dude. You know, people picture the mustache, the sort of like beer league softball body and just crushing home runs. The dude could play center field. He's a great center fielder back in his day.
The warning track was just a suggestion to him.
Yeah, you're right. That's right. All right, well, that's where we'll leave it here. Hopefully, there'll be an occasion to podcast in the near future. Hopefully, there'll be baseball in our near future. We will find out. Lot to find out here in the next few weeks. But thanks for joining us, Tom Hodricourt and Todd Rosiak. Enjoy your whatever this social distancing life is that we're living, and we will chat with you again soon.
Everyone stay safe and healthy, please.
And listen to what people are saying. Don't think you're immune to all of this.
Right. All right, guys, we appreciate it. I appreciate it. We will talk to you again soon. Take care.
Thanks.